Welcome to the Weekly Beat by Mansa with your hosts Arnold Segawa, Maggie Mutesi, and Dumi Jere, giving you all the info on Africa's big finance and economic stories. The Weekly Beat by Mansa.
Greetings and welcome to the Weekly Beat. Arnold Segawa, as always, I'm not alone. My very pertinent and always present co-host, Maggie Mutesi, I'm not very sure where she is today. And always also Dumi Jere, who is in Eswatini today. A very big day today as we delve into the conversation around mining. We do have one of the heavy hitters on this mining space, the founder of Norge Mining. That's Herr Michael Vomza. Let me start with the dear guest. Well, I think it's only fair that I find out where Maggie is before we bring in the founder of Norge Mining. Maggie, where are you today?
I'm in Geneva, Arnold.
That's always a start. I'm sure your passport is running out of pages. Dumi, how are you doing?
I'm all right, my brother. How are you doing? How are things in SA today?
Not bad at all. It's getting warmer. You know, clearly spring is here. So time to get out those shorts. I've been working on my legs too. Herr Vomza, good to have you on this particular edition. I mean, where do we start? Mining at a time when the commodities boom. We all know it's always a cyclical movement, but looks like commodities are making a comeback. Just the other day, the UNCTAD's Global Commodities Forum was underway. And, you know, again, the same things that we've heard reiterated countless times are again on the table, diversifying and all this. As someone coming from the private sector, what were your two cents at this particular forum?
First of all, thank you very much for having me here. It's for me an honor to talk to you guys and to speak a little bit about the whole commodity sector in general. It was very interesting yesterday. You know, you see that, you know, in the last decades, mining was just, you know, so-called, quote-unquote, dirty business, which was performed everywhere, but not in front of my house door. And you read about that in the press. So basically, but yesterday, it was quite clear that with a good way of mining, one can really also contribute to a greener planet, actually, because as I stated yesterday, the protection of the climate and the environment starts at the very beginning where you dig out the stuff of the ground. And there you have also the biggest impact and biggest leverage when you want to really do something for the climate. And it was a very interesting conversation also, you know. This is not only about we do mining in Europe and we try to change the world and make it greener, because there are also other regions in the world which need mining and commodity for living. So these are things which, as I realized yesterday, also must be respected and also put into the whole concept of green mining. One has to be really aware all of these countries that for decades have been mining and have had commodities as a source and base for living. So this is something which was for me also, which I could take away from this gathering yesterday, which was very important for me also.
I just want to ask, Michael, when you say, you know, it's important to realize that we don't get the minerals here in Europe. Obviously, this is a question or a conversation that has been happening. Even now at the Commodities Forum, I mean, one of the questions is, with big corporations, big companies like these, when it comes to mining, oftentimes the question is, how do smaller economies, especially here in Africa, benefit from this beyond just the exporting? And is this something your company or is this something that you are considering?
Yes, you know, the thing is like that. The Europeans, until today, were just consumers of raw materials that we source, let's say now, in particular from Africa. So that's what I said before. You know, we just consume and we buy. And, but, oh, if there's mining in front of my house door, I'm not sure if I want that like this, you know. But of course, if you put it to another context and you say there's something you can do in mining and you can change something in a good way, then, of course, then it's a different approach. Now about Africa, for smaller economies, for instance, I mean, my view, look, I'm in Switzerland, I'm in the UK. And when I'm looking from the outside to the last decades about mining and commodity in Africa, I have the impression that those ones that benefited from all of that were large corporates. They benefited from, and I say now in a very nice way. So in a very politically correct way. So they benefited, I mean, low labor costs, the regulations were quite not too tight. And this was a big benefit for these big corporations, but it was mostly on the expense of the African people, of the climate and of the environment. And that must stop now, because in the end of the day, people in those smaller economies, this is their income. And with that, they can buy their bread and the meat to eat. So you cannot just cut it out and say, okay, listen, we have to be sustainable. No. But what we rather should do, and this is what we spoke about yesterday as well, I think we should partner with those economies in Africa, partner with them and maybe have workshops with them and help them, for instance, to become also energy hubs or battery hubs, because I believe in Africa, there's a lot of commodities. Why not building, for instance, a battery factory in a place where you get cobalt out of the ground or where you get nickel out of the ground? Why getting out of the ground and shipping it with long distances, with ships and trucks to Europe or to China or to wherever? Because that is something where you can save a lot on CO2 output and where you can do a lot for the climate. And I think that is a very big important factor. I think supporting African economies, smaller economies by how to, for instance, build such manufacturers of batteries, for instance. And I would go for batteries because all the car manufacturers want electrical cars. They don't want any more fossil cars. And by the way, it is also good for an African nation who has lots of oil. It's also good to diversify, because if the whole car industry strives into a direction of battery cars, also the demand for fossil will go back. So this will have a double impact also on African economies. First of all, they diversify and have a second leg of a future income. And secondly, by doing that, they also do something for the climate and for their own environment, and of course also for their own people.
Michael, there is something that I'm passionate about, food security. And we cannot have a conversation around food security without also thinking about how the things that we're doing for food security are affecting the earth or the climate that we are in. So I'll give you an example. Growing up, one of the things that I didn't enjoy doing the most was putting fertilizer whenever we plant maize. My grandmother was very passionate about that, and I did not enjoy the act of putting fertilizer. Now, when we look at something like fertilizer, obviously that is what is mined, or that what comes out. There's different kinds of fertilizer, nitrogen. And the switch, as I've been keeping up with things that have been going on, the switch from nitrogen to phosphate, definitely that's something that we could call green, correct?
Absolutely. You're putting it really to the right point, because number three on producing greenhouse gas, number three is nitrogenic gas. And the switch from nitrogen gas to phosphate, only that part on its own is doing a great positive thing for the climate. Also, you must know that phosphate, for instance, is a natural mineral that human beings have it in the body, animals have it in the body, the plants have it in the structures. So if used in a proper way, this natural mineral, you can really do a lot. And it's really, as you say, food security. And this is also why we were extremely surprised that we discovered, because when we did our drillings last year and we calculated that we have the biggest phosphate rock in the world, we did not expect to have the biggest one. We knew it's a lot, but bigger than Morocco as a number one.
Is that in Norway, you mean?
Yeah, the one in Norway. Morocco and Western Sahara, they have approximately, according to the Guardian newspaper, about 50 billion tons of phosphate rock all over the whole region. So, and number two on the ranking is China with 3.5 billion, which is a huge gap. So I expected we would be maybe like China or something like that. But then we have 70 billion tons of phosphate. 70, and this is 50% more nearly. And we are lucky that our phosphate rock has no impurities. So we don't have any cadmium inside. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Morocco, there is the problem with cadmium. Cadmium is a cancerous impurity inside of the stone. That comes also with the structure of the stone. Morocco, Western Sahara, they have sedimentary stone, which is fossil. And we have magmatic stone. So it's a much stronger rock, but there is no impurities.
Yeah. So where does Kazakhstan come in?
Kazakhstan, I would say it's in the size China, maybe a little bit smaller, I would say.
Okay.
So, and there are also North African countries, other countries in the region, Syria also, Israel, Egypt. Now, China, for instance, and now comes your what you said, food security. China has a population of 1.5 billion people. Food security is a big issue. They would need it for themselves. And I'm wondering why it's not being supported by Morocco. I know that Morocco exports 70% of it to India, because India has also over a billion of population.
Mm. Africa also has a billion population.
Yeah, and I'm wondering why African states not cooperating with the other African states more in the south, sub-Sahara and further down. This is something I don't understand. So, yeah.
The Morocco issue, I think, comes back to consumption, because much of the continent, if someone is doing subsistence farming around the equator or around the tropics, they might not necessarily comprehend the rationale for fertilizers and phosphates and adding calcium maybe here and there to the land. Most Asian countries, at least with the revolution that happened in parts of Asia, this is what, in the 80s and the 70s, they embarked on a very, very stellar drive towards higher yields driven by irrigation and what have you, and fertilizers. I think also the mindset has to change in much of the region here in Africa, you know, to move towards fertilizer. So I think the Moroccan example vis-a-vis what's happening down south, the demand for fertilizer and phosphates in much of sub-Saharan Africa has just been non-existent. Don't even get me started on the climate, which is a bit more conducive for farming as it is, you know, so they might not necessarily understand. You have to really talk them through the need for fertilizer.
Okay. I mean, for instance, one could think of is take the phosphate rock out from where we are and not process it, but just take the phosphate rock out, break it down, and then ship it down to Africa and then process it in Africa, because then you have actually the benefit of even creating employment, for instance, and know-how also. So these are things one could think of. However, we have to be careful. These are things one can calculate quite easily. These are approaches which I would think would make sense, would be clever, you know. The phosphate, when you sell the phosphate, there's various possibilities. You just sell it like very raw in the rock, and that is the cheapest product. And then you just export it, or you take it out and you process it yourself and you sell it for much more. But if you can create the value at the place where they need it, for instance, in Africa, then that would be an approach to look, okay, we ship the phosphate rock down to Africa. It's a cheap product, so they can afford to buy it. It's not expensive, but they can then create by themselves value. I mean, that would be, for instance, a very interesting approach. And I'm sure that there is also public bodies that would support something like that. I'm sure.
Michael, I also wanted to ask you about the issue around geomapping. You mentioned the huge discovery just made in Norway just the other day, you know, and one would have thought the years that the mining space has been thriving in a country like Norway or even around the North Sea, you would have thought, you know, there's not that many discoveries to be made. But I'm quite surprised. It's actually news to me that something of this magnitude is still being unearthed. The geomapping issue has been something that has scourged the continent, at least when it comes to the mining space. For mining ministers to come out there and present a budget, you know, in millions of dollars, just so that they can get an idea what's under the ground, it's hard to pass in many parliaments across sub-Saharan Africa. Give me a sense of, do you get a sense that maybe something can be done vis-a-vis private sector space action, stakeholders like yourself, to maybe facilitate the idea of geomapping across some potential mines out there in the continent?
And an interesting question, because that was also our topic in the beginning, the geomapping. So what happened when we started, we had five licenses covering about 45 square kilometers. And then when we send our geologists to take the rock out of the ground just to do sampling and send it to the laboratories for research and to see how much is there, what's the concentration, etc. So we took out about 3 tons of stone. But at this time, 2019, our geologists said, hey, this region is much bigger than the 5 licenses that it is stated on the Norwegian Geological Survey. You must buy more licenses and cover the entire region. And they showed us where to cover it. And we bought in the end 40 more licenses. So we cover now 400 square kilometers. This is 2.5 times the size of Paris. And then exactly came now, and this is to answer your question. We were confronted with that huge, huge surface. Now, how do you find out where is what and where? What is there in this place? And so what you can do, you can raise tens of millions and then start drilling and hope that you hit something. But I did not want to go that route because it was time consuming, 3-4 years, and it was extremely costly. So what we did, and this is something one should really seriously think about it, we just rented a helicopter and for 2 months, and this helicopter was flying over our region for 2 months, doing 3,500 kilometers and measuring with electromagnetic technology the entire region. What happened then, it gave us a lot of data. It gave us in the end, the product in the end after these flights was a 3D model of the ore body in the ground. So we knew how large it is, how deep it reaches down, how much it goes to the east, to the west, to the east. So we had a clear, clear picture. And we knew exactly then, 2 months later only, where to drill. So this, of course, you can only do with certain types of minerals, but it also, the technology now is really far, is really sensible and good. So I think something like that should be applied in Africa, for instance. If geologists say there's a region 250 square kilometers there between this country and that country, and the region is quite difficult to access because there's a lot of forestry and jungles, etc. So you can just apply a helicopter with the most modern technology and do the first research. And as a first research, it will reward you with a really clear picture what is there. This is something where you can do in a very efficient, cost-efficient, time-efficient way, the geomapping. And I think something like that should be more applied much more.
And interesting indeed. It really sounds like the future of geomapping. I remember Kenya did some geomapping sometime. It took, I think, over a year, you know, to get some tangible results. And if you're saying in 2 months you can have something, it's quite baffling and you know, definitely the future. Michael, I'm afraid we're running out of time, and we have run out of time, sorry. Thank you for making time to speak to us. Many thanks to my co-hosts, Dumi Jerry and Maggie Mutasi, also Arnold Segawa. We just listened to the founder of Norge Mining, that's Michael Vamza, and fascinating stuff indeed. The future of mining is here, and you heard that obviously on Mansa's The Weekly Beat. If you missed anything in the course of the week, just visit the website. That's mansamedia.africa or on Twitter for live updates. Don't hesitate to check out the Twitter page and also follow us at Mansa_media for me and the entire gang. Have a lovely one.
The Weekly Beat by Mansa with your hosts, Arnold Segawa, Maggie Mutesi, and Dumi Jerry, giving you all the info on Africa's big finance and economic stories. The Weekly Beat by Mansa.